Bartimaeus, Chapter 41. Werewolves in the street, Nathaniel back indoors. Which would you choose? Truth to tell, I was glad to get out and about for a bit. His behaviour was disconcerting me more and more. In the years since our first encounter, doubtless under Whitwell's careful tutelage, he'd become an officious little beast, carefully obeying his orders with one eye always on promotion. Now he was deliberately going out on a limb, doing things underhand and risking much by so doing. This was no home-grown idea. Someone was putting him up to it. Someone was pulling his strings. He'd been many things to me, Nathaniel had, most of them indescribable. But he'd never looked so much of a puppet as he did now. And already it had all gone wrong. The scene below was one of chaos. Wounded creatures lay here and there across the street, amid piles of broken brick and glass. They writhed and growled and clutched their flanks, their contours altering with each spasm. Man, wolf, man, wolf. That's the problem with lycanthropy. It's so hard to control. Pain and strong emotion make the body shift. This chronic unreliability is one of the reasons why werewolves get such a bad press, as is the fact that they're ravenous, savage, bloodthirsty, and very poorly house-trained. Lycaon of Arcadia assembled the first wolf corps as his personal bodyguard, way back about 2000 BC, and despite the fact that they promptly ate several of his houseguests, the notion of them fulfilling a useful enforcing role stuck fast. Many tyrannical rulers who had recourse to magic have used them ever since, casting complex transformation spells over suitably brawny humans, keeping them in isolation and sometimes carrying out breeding programs to improve the strain. As with so much else, it was Gladstone who inaugurated the British Night Police. He knew their worth as instruments of fear. The girl had downed about five, I thought, not including the one blown to pieces by the elemental sphere. But several more were pacing redundantly in the road, and others, displaying a little more intelligence, were busily scaling drainpipes or searching for fire escapes to climb. Nine or ten were left alive. Too much for any human to handle. But she was still fighting. I saw her now, a little whirling figure on the rooftop. Something bright flashed in each hand. She was waving them high and low in little desperate feints and thrusts to keep three wolves at bay. But with every turn she made, the black forms inched a little closer. A scarab beetle, for all its many qualities, is not much cop in a fight. Besides, it would have taken about an hour to fly across to join the action. So I made my change, flapped my great red wings twice, and was upon them in a flash. My wings blocked out the moon, casting the four combatants on the roof into the blackest of shadows. For good measure, I uttered the fearsome cry of the rock as it swoops down upon the elephants to snatch away their young. Indian elephants, usually. The rocks live on remote isles on the Indian Ocean, appearing inland, infrequently, in search of prey. Their nests were an acre across, their eggs vast white domes visible far out across the sea. The adults were formidable opponents, and sank most ships sent out to pillage the nesting sites by dropping rocks from a great height. The caliphs paid huge sums for rocks' feathers, cut by stealth from the breast of the sleeping bird. All this had the appropriate effect. One of the wolves leaped a meter backwards, its brindled fur fluffed in fright, and disappeared with a howl over the edge of the parapet. Another reared up on its hind legs and received a blow in the midriff from the rock's clenched talons. It shot into the air like a fluffy football and vanished with a clatter behind a chimney. The third, which was standing upright in parody of a man, was more nimble, quicker thinking. The rock's arrival had caught the girl by surprise, too. Gawping up in wonder at the splendour of my plumage, she lowered her knives. Without a sound, the wolf leaped at her throat. Its teeth clashed together, sending bitter sparks flying into the night. The girl was already several metres up and rising, suspended from my claws. Her hair streamed in front of her face, her legs dangled above the rapidly diminishing rooftop, the street, and all its scurrying inhabitants. The noises of fury and disappointment receded, and we were suddenly alone, suspended high above the infinite lights of the city, drawn upwards by my protective wings into a place of calm tranquillity.
Ow! That's my leg! Ow! Ah! Curse you! That's silver! Stop it!
The girl was stabbing a knife repeatedly into the scaly flesh just above my talons.
Can you credit it?
This same leg, remember, was preventing her from falling to a sooty destruction amid the smokestacks of East London.
I ask you.
I pointed this out to her with my usual elegance.
There's no need to swear, demon,
she said, desisting for a moment. Her voice was high and faint upon the wind.
And anyway, I don't care. I want to die.
Believe me, if I could only help you out.
Stop that!
Another prick of pain, another woozy sensation in my head. Silver does that to you. Much more of it, and we'd both be falling. I shook her vigorously until her teeth rattled and her knives plummeted from her hand. But even that wasn't the end of it. Now she began twisting and wrenching back and forth in a fevered effort to loose my grip. The rock tightened its hold.
Will you stop wriggling, girl? I'm not going to drop you, but I will hold you head first over a tanner's chimney. I don't care.
Or dunk you in the Thames.
I don't care.
Or take you to Rotherhithe Sewage Works and...
I don't care, I don't care, I don't care.
She seemed apoplectic with rage and grief, and even with my rock strength, it was all I could do to prevent her prizing herself free. Kitty Jones, I said, keeping my eyes fixed on the lights of North London. We were nearing our destination now. Do you not want to see Jacob Herneck again? She went quiet then, all limp and thoughtful, and we flew on for a while in a state of blessed silence. I used the respite to circle for a time, keeping a weather eye out for pursuing spheres. But all was still. We flew on. A voice sounded from somewhere below my wishbone. It was more measured than before, but the fire had not gone out of it.
Demon, it said, why didn't you let the wolves devour me? I know that you and your masters plan to kill me in any case.
I can't comment on that, the rock said, but feel free to thank me, if you wish.
Are you taking me to see Jacob now?
Yes, if all goes as planned.
And then?
I was silent. I had a fairly good idea.
Well, speak up.
And speak truthfully, if you can. In an attempt to change the subject, the rock affected disdain. I'd be careful, love. It's unwise to make catty remarks when suspended at high altitude. As exemplified by Icarus, an early pioneer of flight. According to Fakwal, who admittedly wasn't the most reliable of sources, the Greek magician Daedalus constructed a pair of magical wings, each one housing a short-tempered foliate. These wings were tested by Icarus, a fey and facetious youth, who made cheap remarks at the foliate's expense while at several thousand feet above the Aegean. In protest, they loosed their feathers one by one, sending Icarus and his witticisms plummeting to a watery grave.
Huh. You're not going to drop me. You just said.
Oh, yes, so I did, the rock sighed. The truth is, I do not know what is planned for you. Now shut your trap a minute. I'm coming in to land. We sank through the darkness, across the ocean of orange lights, down to the street where the boy and I had sheltered on the night of the Underwood fire. The ruined library was still there. I could see its bulk, sandwiched amongst the lights of the smaller shops around. The building had deteriorated somewhat in the intervening years, and a sizable hole now yawned in one place, where a large glass skylight had fallen away. The rock diminished in scale as it approached, judged the angle carefully, popped the girl feet first through the hole, as if posting a letter. We descended into the cavernous space, lit here and there by shafts of moonlight. Only when we were a safe distance from the rubble of the floor did I let my burden go. We were about 2 meters up. Hey, she was young and bouncy. She dropped with a squeak and rolled briefly. I alighted a little way off and appraised her properly for the first time. It was the same one, all right. The girl in the alley who had tried to pinch the amulet. She looked older now, thinner and more jaded, her face grey and drawn, and the eyes wary. The last few years had been hard for her, I reckoned. The last few minutes positively cruel. One arm hung limp, its shoulder slashed and caked with blood. Even so, the defiance in her was palpable. She got carefully to her feet, and with chin studiedly aloft, stared at me from across a column of silver light.
"I don't think much of this," she snapped. "Can't you interrogate me somewhere cleaner? I was expecting the tower, at least."
"This is preferable, believe me." The rock was sharpening a claw against the wall. I wasn't in much of a mood for conversation.
"Well, get on with it, then. Where's Jacob? Where are the magicians?"
"They'll be along in a bit."
"In a bit? What kind of outfit is this?"
She put her hands on her hips.
"I thought you lot were meant to be terrifyingly efficient. This is all cock-eyed."
I raised my great plumed head. "Now listen," I said. "Don't forget that I've just saved you from the jaws of the night police. A little gratitude wouldn't go amiss here, young lady." The rock rapped its talons meaningfully on the floor and fixed her with the kind of look that sends Persian sailors diving overboard. She fixed me with the kind of look that curdles milk.
"Get lost, demon. I defy you and your wickedness. You don't frighten me."
"No?"
"No.
You're just a useless imp. Your feathers are mangy and covered in mould."
"What?"
The rock made a hurried inspection. "Rubbish. That's the moonlight giving it that sheen."
"It's a wonder they haven't fallen out. I've seen pigeons with better plumage."
"Now listen."
"I've destroyed demons with real power," she cried. "Think I'll be impressed by an overgrown chicken?"
The cheek of the girl. "This noble rock," I said with bitter dignity, "is not my only form. It is but one of 100,000 guises I can assume. For instance..." The rock reared up. I became, in quick succession, a ferocious red-eyed minotaur, frothing at the mouth, a granite gargoyle, champing with its jaws, a thrashing serpent, spitting venom, a moaning ghost, a walking cadaver, a floating Aztec skull, gleaming in the dark. It was a motley assortment of nastiness, if I say so myself. If not particularly inventive, I was tired and out of sorts. "Well?" the skull inquired, meaningfully. "Care to comment?" She swallowed audibly.
"Not bad," she said. "But all those guises are big and showy. I bet you can't do subtle."
"Of course I can."
"I bet you can't go extra small. Say, small enough to get into that bottle over there."
She pointed at the end of a beer bottle, poking out from under a pile of litter, while all the time watching me out of the corner of her eye.
"That old one! If it's been tried on me once, it's been tried 100 times.
The skull shook itself slowly from side to side and grinned. Actually, it was grinning already, grinning being one of the few things skulls do really well. "Nice effort, but that didn't work on me, even in the old days. You know the trick. The clever mortal convinces the stupid jinni to squeeze inside a bottle or some other confined space, then stoppers him up, refuses to let him out until he grants 3 wishes, etc., etc. Ho-hum. Unlikely as it may seem, however, if the jinni enters the bottle of his own free will, this entrapment actually has a fair degree of power. But even the smallest, doziest imp is unlikely to fall for this old chestnut today. Now," I went on, "why don't you sit down and rest? You look dog-tired." The girl sniffed, pouted, and folded her arms painfully. I could see her looking around, weighing up the exits. "And don't try anything," I advised, "or I'll brain you with a rafter."
"Hold it in your teeth, will you?"
Ooh, she was disdainful. In answer, the skull faded and became Ptolemy. I altered without thinking. It's always my preferred form. Take it as a mark of respect for what he did for me. But as soon as I did so, I saw her give a start and step back a pace.
"You! The demon in the alley!"
"Don't get so excited. You can't blame me for that occasion. You jumped me." She grunted.
"True. The night police nearly caught me then, too."
"You ought to be more careful. What did you want the amulet of Samarkand for, anyway?" The girl looked blank.
"The what? Oh, the jewel. Well, it was magical, wasn't it? We stole magical artifacts in those days. It was the whole point of our group, robbing the magicians, trying to use their stuff ourselves. Stupid. Really stupid." She kicked out at a brick. "Ow!" Do I take it you no longer espouse this policy?
Hardly, since it got us all killed.
Except you. Her eyes flashed in the dark.
You truly expect me to survive tonight?
She had a point here. You never know, I said heartily. My master may attempt to spare you. He has already saved you from the wolves. She snorted.
Your master? Does he have a name?
John Mandrake is the one he uses. I was banned by my vow from saying more.
Him? That pretentious little fool?
Oh, you've met him, then?
Twice. And the last time I did, I punched his lights out.
Did you? No wonder he kept quiet about it.
I was liking this girl more and more with every moment. In truth, she was a breath of fresh air. In all the long centuries of my toil, I've spent remarkably little time in the company of commoners.
By instinct, magicians try to keep us shadowy and removed from ordinary men and women. I can count the number of commoners I've properly conversed with on the claws of one hand. Of course, by and large, it isn't a rewarding process, the equivalent of a dolphin chatting up a sea slug, but you do get the occasional exception. And this Kitty Jones was one. I liked her style. I snapped my fingers and caused a small illumination to fly up and lodge among the rafters. From a nearby heap of rubble, I pulled some planks and breeze blocks and arranged them as a chair. "Sit yourself down," I said. "Make yourself comfortable." "That's right." "So, you punched John Mandrake, did you?" She spoke with a certain grim satisfaction.
"Yes. You seem amused."
I stopped guffawing.
"Oh, can you tell?"
"Odd, given that you and he are aligned in wickedness, given that you carry out his every whim."
"Aligned in wickedness?
Hey, there is a certain master-servant thing going on here, you know. I'm a slave. I have no choice in the matter."
Her lip curled. "Just obeying orders, eh?"
"Sure, that's a great excuse." "It is when to disobey means certain destruction. You try the shriveling fire on your bones. See if you like it."
She frowned. "It sounds a pretty ropey excuse to me. You're saying all your evil is performed unwillingly?"
"I wouldn't put it quite like that, but..."
"Yup. From imp to afreet, we're all bound to the magician's will. We can't do anything about it. They have us over a barrel.
At the moment, for instance, I have to help and protect Mandrake, whether I like it or not."
"Pathetic," she spoke decisively. "Absolutely pathetic."
And indeed, as I heard myself say all this, it did seem so to me, too. We slaves have dwelt so long in these chains of ours that we rarely speak of them. Only a few, such as old Fakwal, openly and hopelessly plot revolt. But they've been wittering on about it for so long without results that no one pays any attention. To hear the resignation in my own voice sickened my essence to its core. I tried to batten down my shame with a spot of righteous indignation.
"Oh, we fight back," I said. "We catch them out if they're careless, and misinterpret when we can. We encourage them to vie with one another, and set them at each other's throats. We load them with luxuries until their bodies grow fat and their minds too dull to notice their own downfall. We do our best, which is more than you humans manage to do most of the time."
At this, the girl uttered a strange, ragged laugh.
"What do you think I've been trying to do all these years? Sabotaging government, stealing artifacts, disrupting the city. It's been hopeless, the whole thing. I might as well have been a secretary, like my mother wanted. My friends have been killed or corrupted, and demons like you have done it all. And don't tell me you don't enjoy it. That thing in the crypt loved every second of—"
Her body gave a violent shudder. She broke off, rubbed her eyes. "Well, there are exceptions," I began, then desisted. As if a thin barrier had been broached, the girl's shoulders shook, and she suddenly began to cry with great spasms of pent-up grief. She did so silently, stifling the noise with her fist, as if to save me embarrassment. I didn't know what to say. It was all very awkward. She went on a long time. I sat myself, cross-legged, a little way off, turning respectfully away from her, and gazed off into the shadows.
Where was the boy?
Come on, come on. He was taking his time. Pathetic.
absolutely pathetic. Try as I might to ignore them, her words gnawed away at me in the still of the night.